Democrat Party, and it's openly inviting millions of illegal aliens to break our laws, violate our borders, and overwhelm our nation.
What the hell's going on in America? Ripping infants from their mother's arms at the borders. What are we doing? What have we become?
Joe Biden at a rally in Las Vegas. President Trump at a rally in Elko, Nevada, both on Saturday. President Obama was in Nevada yesterday. That state is getting all this attention because it's one of those purple states that's vital to both parties in the upcoming midterms. In the Senate race there, Democrat Jackie Rosen and incumbent Republican Dean Heller are basically tied in the polls. We're going to talk about this now with John Ralston, editor of the Nevada Independent. Hey, John.
Hi there.
Well, Donald Trump's national approval ratings seem to be climbing. Is that showing up in Nevada as well?
Well, his numbers here have never been quite as bad as they are in some other so-called purple or bluish states, Madeline, but they're not great. He's still generally upside down, meaning his disapproval is higher than his approval, but it's not so far underwater that it's been being a complete drag on the ticket. And of course, he's very, very popular in rural Nevada.
Well, Dean Heller wasn't a fan for a while. In fact, he and Trump would go at each other, mainly over the Affordable Care Act. Now they seem to be best buddies. Is that a winning strategy for Heller?
Well, first of all, best buddies is an understatement. When Trump was in Elko, Nevada, just a couple of days ago, Heller went up on stage and said, "Everything you touch turns to gold, Mr. President." So I think the word fawning might apply. This is a very, very calculated political strategy because, as you mentioned, Heller was once almost a never Trumper, saying he was 99% against him in 2016. But he's clearly made the calculation that in a low turnout election where the base turnout, the Republican base turnout, is most important, he's going to do the full embrace of Trump. And he hopes that that will save him, even though Trump's numbers are underwater and his numbers are underwater.
Well, so the Republican National Committee, though, apparently is flooding the state with volunteers, right? And they are getting their political organization together?
The Republicans have really done a remarkable job in Nevada, probably the most remarkable job since I started covering politics here way too long ago, Madeline, and that is that they have a real ground game this time. They came in last year, they've erected an infrastructure here, and they're getting their vote out. Now, the Democrats are getting their vote out too, but they've had a machine here erected by Harry Reid for a long time. The Democrats still have a registration lead, which helps them build up in the early voting period, which lasts 2 weeks and started 3 days ago, a sizable lead generally. That wasn't true 4 years ago, but it doesn't look like that's happening this time.
So Hillary Clinton won Nevada in 2016. Democrats won two congressional races, a Senate seat, control of the state legislature. There's a pretty strong union effort there with the Culinary Union. So how did the Democrats feel about their efforts to get the vote out this time around?
I think they feel good, but I think they also are very, very wary that there have been stories across the country, as you know, about the drop in Latino turnout. That was a big problem for the Democrats here in the last midterm, and they suffered a wipeout. They lost every single statewide office. They are very concerned that the Culinary will be able to get out the Latino vote. About half of the Culinary Union is Hispanic. Many of them are registered. They run a registered voter campaign inside the union. The question is will they vote? There's 3 days of early voting are complete. The Democrats are doing much, much better than in 2014, but the Republicans are holding their own.
Right. And so, you know, it has been a mystery about the Latino turnout, given the fact that Trump continually vilifies migrants from the southern border, most notably recently, this so-called migrant train working its way up from Honduras through Mexico to the border with the United States. Is that not animating Latinos to come to the polls?
We're going to find out. It's too early to tell. What I will say is that that's a double-edged sword. It is going to animate at least some Latinos, but it also drives up the rural white vote here. Immigration, even though we're not a border state, is always right near the top in polls in the Senate race on what is the most important issue to you. And so that issue, which Trump, as you know, used to help him win the presidency, Heller is clearly trying to use. He's mentioned sanctuary cities several times during the campaign. So he's trying to drive up the rural and white vote while the Democrats are trying to turn out Latinos. That's really what it's all about here.
So do you see this as a bellwether, Nevada, the Nevada Senate race, as a bellwether for the rest of the country?
And we're such a weird state, Madeline. I don't know if we can ever be called a bellwether for anything. But certainly, I think Nevada is, despite that reputation, more of a microcosm of America because of Las Vegas and the changing demographics and the growing minority population. And also because we're one of the most urban states in the country, even though we have this vast expanse of 15 counties between Reno and Las Vegas. And so the whole rural versus urban dynamic is coming into play. So I guess in that sense, we may be a bellwether.
John Ralston, he is editor of the Nevada Independent. Thanks, John.
Always a pleasure.
Just like in Nevada, races across the country are tightening just 2 weeks ahead of Election Day. That's particularly true in some races Democrats need to win if they want to retake the House. Just look at Orange County. A new poll gives Republican Dana Rohrabacher a slight lead over his Democratic challenger, Harley Ruda. And that's a reverse from a few months ago. And in another bad sign for Democrats, President Trump's approval rating is at its highest yet. 47%. He's still underwater. 49% disapprove. Here to talk about whether Democrats should temper their expectations of a big blue wave is Sean Sullivan. He covers national politics for The Washington Post. Hi, Sean.
Hi, good to be with you.
Well, given that poll and other polls, is talk of a blue wave overblown, do you think?
Well, at this point, with exactly 2 weeks left until the election, we're not hearing as much optimism from Democrats about a massive blue wave that would deliver them to a really, really significant majority in the House and possibly put them on the cusp of a majority in the Senate. Now, that said, Democrats are still favored to win control of the House. They need to pick up 23 seats. And right now, when you talk to strategists in both parties and you talk to nonpartisan analysts, they believe that is going to happen, but it's less of a foregone conclusion than it was in their minds a few weeks ago, and there are a number of reasons why that is the case.
And is one of those reasons simply that people are just paying attention now more than they were previously, and they're sort of hardening what they want and who they're going to vote for?
Yeah, it seems to be a combination of factors, and one is indeed the fact that we are 2 weeks before the election and people are tuning in more and more. And strategists on both sides of the partisan divide say, look, you know, Democrats have been energized, excited to vote in this election for almost 2 years. And on the Republican side, it's taken more time for their base to get motivated, to engage in this election. And now that we're moving closer and closer to it, more and more of them are paying attention, are getting out, voting early in some cases. And so that's one major factor. Another is that President Trump's approval rating, his image across the nation, is better for him than it was a few months ago. And the third factor that Republicans and Democrats see, more so on the Republican side, is the confirmation of Brett Kavanaugh to the Supreme Court. Republicans believe this has galvanized conservative voters to show up at the polls and vote, even though Trump is not on the ballot. They feel that it gives them a concrete accomplishment that will motivate them to support Republican candidates because these Republicans are supporting Trump's agenda.
Why is Trump's approval rating going up?
Well, that is something that is up for debate right now. And to be clear, to put it in the right context, his approval rating is not strong right now. Many, many people disapprove of the job he's doing. So it's relatively better than it was a few months ago. And some of that may have to do with these accomplishments that he has touted, which Republicans, conservatives, his hardcore base, really, really like. And Kavanaugh is certainly the biggest one that he and the party are touting right now as a concrete achievement. So some of this may be the fact that you have conservatives who are more excited, more engaged with the president, but The challenge for Republicans is that in a lot of suburban moderate swing districts that could determine the House majority, president's still very, very unpopular, very, very polarizing. And there are a lot of people who don't like him who will not vote for the candidates of his party. So it's still an uphill climb for the Republican Party right now with 2 weeks to go.
Well, when it comes to those suburban districts, and a lot of them are here in California, we talked about Orange County as being key to the House, to the possible House takeover by Democrats. Are the candidates in those races, are they, the Republicans, are they campaigning on a Trump agenda? Are they mentioning Trump? Are they trying to distance themselves from him?
Many of them are trying to distance themselves from him. Many of them are trying to focus on local issues, things that are unique about their district or accomplishments if they're incumbents that they have created or added to the local economy, for example. So in many of these cases, these Republicans have looked at the polling in their district and concluded a long time ago that they can't link themselves to Trump. They can't link themselves to his policies. And that's been challenging for a lot of these Republicans to go to voters and try to convince them to give them two more years, because sometimes voters aren't clear what it is that they're running on. On the Democratic side, it seems that it's very clear that Democrats in a lot of these districts are running on a change platform, that the last 2 years of Republican rule, Republican control in Congress and the White House have not worked out. And they are talking about what they call kitchen table issues, health care, taxes. These were the things that Republicans were trying to work on policy-wise, but it's actually the Democrats who are running on these issues right now. They're casting Republicans as people who will take away health care protections, who are not fighting for the middle class when it comes to taxes. So it's been a challenging balancing act for these Republicans in suburban districts because they can't align themselves too closely with Trump, but if they run too far away from him, then they risk losing some of his most loyal supporters.
Yeah, interesting. Well, meanwhile, he's out campaigning pretty much nonstop. He, as we said earlier, he's been in Nevada, and here he is in Texas. He was at a rally last night for Senator Ted Cruz in Houston, where he talks a lot about California, in particular, California Democrat Maxine Waters.
Maxine Waters! You get that one? You get that? Maxine. She's going to be in charge of your finances. Maxine. Good old Maxine. Low IQ individual. Low IQ.
Okay. So she's African American. He actually called himself a nationalist last night. What is he doing?
Well, right now, Republicans, starting with the president and going all the way down to House candidates and Senate candidates, are running a campaign that is heavily rooted in fear and division, and they're casting Democratic candidates as scary figures, as extremists, as people who, if they took power, would instill mob rule around the country. They're trying to stoke fears among their base and warn them and say, if you're thinking about not voting in this election, think twice, and here's why. In a lot of these districts, though, around the country, the Democrats on the ballot are running as centrists. They are not embracing some of the planks of the left wing of the Democratic Party. In many cases, these Democrats are not running on single-payer health care or running on abolishing ICE, say. But the Republicans are trying to link all of the Democrats to the liberals who embrace those proposals. So right now, you know, what we're seeing is a closing argument for Republicans rooted in fear. And in a lot of cases, in some of these ads, Democrats say is, you know, racism and sexism on the part of the Republicans as well when they are running these attack ads.
Right. Well, so why Maxine Waters in particular? I mean, when you're talking about fear and you're talking about racism and you're constantly bringing up an African-American member of Congress and calling her low IQ, well, I mean, how can you say that that's not racist?
And, you know, when you look at the people that Trump has singled out on for criticism, he has tended to go after people who have been very, very vocal critics of him and his administration and of Republicans. And Maxine Waters is one of those people. But, you know, we have heard time and again that from Democrats that, look, the Republican campaign in 2018 is very much the Republican campaign as it was in 2016, which is rooted in, you know, if not outright racism, you know, racial dog whistles is what some Democrats say is the root of the Republican playbook right now.
Sean Sullivan covers politics for The Washington Post. Thanks, Sean.
Thank you.
Coming up, how the Beverly Hills School District is using bond money meant for school repairs to pay for lawsuits against the subway. That's next on Press Play.
Hi, it's Terry Gross, the host of Fresh Air. We bring you in-depth, long-form interviews with actors, directors, musicians, authors, journalists, and more. Listen to our Peabody Award-winning Fresh Air podcast from WHYY and NPR.
This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand.
Save our school! Save our school! Save
students in Beverly Hills protesting the extension of the Purple Line earlier this month. Work on the extension from Koreatown to Westwood has already begun, but the Beverly Hills School District has been fighting it ever since plans were first introduced for the Purple Line about 6 years ago. And that's because the Purple Line will run right underneath Beverly Hills High. The district says it's worried about students breathing bad air from all the construction work and the possibility there might be an explosion from oil and gas pockets that sit underground. The district has filed 4 lawsuits to halt construction. There have been protests, and it turns out that a lot of that activity is being paid for with school bond money, money that was supposed to be used to improve aging school facilities. Laura Bliss is a staff writer at City Lab for The Atlantic. She's been following this. Hi.
Hi. Thanks so much for having me.
Great to have you. So it seems like there has been a concerted effort, to put it mildly, on the part of the Beverly Hills School District to oppose this extension, and they've used various arguments. What have been the arguments over the years, and what has been their reception in court?
The idea to extend a subway line through Beverly Hills has been around for decades and decades, and there have been various groups locally who've opposed this idea very fervently for a variety of reasons. For the school and the district, their argument currently is not that they oppose, you know, a subway station in Beverly Hills point blank. It's that they have a lot of concerns over the placement of that station, of that route, and the station beneath the high school campus. And there are lawsuits dating back to 2012 at both the county courts and fighting the FTA right at the federal level, too, have largely hinged on this idea that ongoing construction could raise health concerns for students, right, with, you know, particulate pollution kicking up and noise distractions. And then also this idea that because Beverly Hills, like much of West L.A. and mid-city L.A., sits on top of an oil field, as some listeners may know, that there could be risk for methane explosions or other kinds of, you know, natural gas-related concerns. And in terms of the reception in court, right, you know, Beverly Hills has not prevailed. Courts have upheld LA Metro at pretty much every turn. They have upheld the extensive environmental reviews that LA Metro has conducted that, you know, assure that these safety concerns could be mitigated, and, you know, pointing to other examples in the city as well as around the world where subway stations and tunnels are safely constructed.
So there's a plan to deal with the particulate matter. There's a plan to make sure that there isn't a methane explosion, that kind of thing.
Yeah, and LA Metro has even also said, in response to a sort of separate concern over the kind of general autonomy of the district to, you know, do construction on their campuses as they hope to. So, you know, one proposal that the district has had for a while is to put an underground parking lot at the high school. Metro has said, you know, we'd be able to accommodate this. But that kind of ties into what my story was looking into this week, which was the fact that this legal fight has been financed in large part by proceeds from a bond, a school bond that voters approved in 2008.
And this bond was meant to do what?
Yeah, so this was called Measure E, again, approved by Beverly Hills voters in 2008, and it was really, like many school bonds, designed to be used to rehabilitate and renovate the school. So some listeners may be familiar with some of their facilities, their, you know, beautiful campuses that date back to the 1920s, but a lot of them are not in great shape, and so these $334 million in general obligation funds that were approved were for modernizing those campuses, making structural seismic repairs, reconstructing classrooms, gyms, libraries, that kind of thing.
And has that been done? Has that money been spent on that?
So there has been some progress on some of those repairs. You know, that the bond outlined and that voters did approve, there hasn't been a lot. And meanwhile, quite a lot of this money that's been issued so far in the intervening years has been spent on financing these successive rounds of litigation. In fact, at least $13 million of those bond proceeds have been spent this way.
Is that legal?
Well, according to the district and according to legal opinions that they did obtain to essentially authorize the use of this money, yes, because, you know, the district wants to build this underground parking lot and, you know, Metro Construction could impinge on that plan. It could impinge on other plans, you know, associated with the projects that voters did approve. But bond counsel and public finance experts from around the state that I spoke to, some of whom were familiar with this project, did say this is an extremely uncommon use of bond proceeds, and that the further you get sort of from that very specified list of projects that voters approve, you know, the harder it is to sort of justify, you know, potentially in court, why it is you're spending all that money on a lawsuit.
Meanwhile, construction continues apace, right? So where is construction on the Purple Line now in the Beverly Hills area?
Yeah, so actually just, I think, Monday of last week, the phase of construction that will eventually reach Beverly Hills kicked off a few miles away. So that was a big landmark for Metro and a kind of landmark in this ongoing battle.
Well, so if it is suspected that Beverly Hills is using this money in an unorthodox and possibly illegitimate way, what is the remedy? Is it yet another lawsuit that someone would have to file against Beverly Hills?
It's a great question. Yes. That could be it. I mean, there are also, I spoke with a high-ranking state finance official who also pointed to an IRS audit. And then also, yeah, you know, another bond counsel pointed out that if citizens were concerned about the expenditure of these funds in this way, they could also bring yet another lawsuit, as you say, into a court of law and have this settled there.
Or not.
Yeah, or not, right?
Settled.
There is a question about, unfortunately, so much this kind of reporting. You know, do people care? I'm not sure. You know, the Beverly Hills voters just approved another big school bond this past June. So, you know, it may be that for some people in the community, this is a perfectly okay use of funds. But it also may not be, right? We definitely know that there are plenty of people and students in Beverly Hills who do not support the district's crusade.
Laura Bliss is a staff writer at City Lab for The Atlantic. Thank you so much.
Thanks for having me.
Coming up, the story of what happened after a men's rights activist filed a discrimination claim against a local brewery for hosting a women's beer forum.
We said that we were happy to accommodate him for the same price that the women were paying to participate in this educational forum. If he wants to learn about the flight, we could happily walk him through it, and he declined.
How the Unruh Act is successfully being used to extract legal settlements from small businesses here in California. That's next on Press Play. This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. A woman named Ting Su owns the Eagle Rock Brewery here in Los Angeles. She noticed that when men and women came in together, the men usually ordered for the women. They seemed to know a lot more about beer. So Ting decided it would be a good idea to offer free seminars for women so they could learn more about beer. But then a man threatened to sue, claiming discrimination against men. He cited California's Unruh Act, which outlaws sex discrimination, among other things. Stephen Fry is his name. He's a member of a group called the National Coalition for Men. That's based in San Diego. And the New York Times reports that that group is responsible for some 300 Unruh lawsuits. Ting Su of the Eagle Rock Brewery joins us now to talk about her particular case. Hello.
Hi.
Also joining us, an expert on the Unruh Act, Ariella Gross. She teaches law at USC. Hi.
Hi.
And just before we get started, we did invite the guy who is suing you or who has filed this complaint against you, Ting, to come on, but his lawyer refused because he took exception to my Twitter feed.
Indeed.
Before we get into the back and forth of all the legal stuff and the Unruh Act, just what was the impetus for starting this? I guess it's a once-a-month forum for women and people who identify as women?
Correct. So when we opened our brewery back in 2009, this is Eagle Rock Brewery, I was still behind the bar all the time. It was a small, independent, family-owned operation. So it was myself, my husband, my father-in-law. I was behind the bar every night then. I noticed there were a lot of couples that would come in, hetero couples, you know, a woman would come to the bar and often try to talk to me about what styles of beer she should try and what she might like. And the male that she was with would almost always kind of just negate any conversation that we had and just say, nah, you should have this. And sometimes it would be accompanied by misinformation. Sometimes it would be accurate, but it just kind of varied. But it just got to the point where I was noticing this so frequently that, you know, I figured it would be grand to have a group or some sort of forum that I could educate women more on beer, just to have a dialogue about it.
And did you say men are not allowed?
No, never expressly stated that. You know, we've had men in there as presenters. We've had men attend as well. I call it a women's beer forum because it's meant to really kind of engage more women in the conversation. I think the issue became there was an email that came in through our general info line.
And this email was from Stephen Fry, the guy who threatened to sue you?
Correct.
And what did he say?
Well, he had sent an email to our general email line and asked if men were allowed to attend the women's beer forum. The response that he got from one of our team, unfortunately, we had not explicitly trained anybody on don't ever say it's just for women. But because it's called the Women's Beer Forum, she responded, the Women's Beer Forum is for women, but men are more than welcome to come and enjoy beers in the tasting room. And that was kind of where everything snowballed for us.
So, Ariella, what do you make of that email? Was that like a... Do you think that was maybe a phishing email, or do you think that this guy genuinely was interested in coming to the forum?
Given that he was a member of this group, National Coalition for Men, which has filed dozens, I believe even hundreds of lawsuits in California and elsewhere targeting women's business groups and tech groups, I doubt that he specifically wanted to learn more about beer and felt that he was being denied an opportunity. That organization brings cases under the Unruh Act to force groups that are trying to foster women in tech and business to force them either to stop doing what they're doing or pay money. And they've been quite successful in shaking down business owners.
And in your particular case, Ting, you decided to settle with him rather than go through the process of fighting this in court.
Correct. And it was an incredibly challenging decision for us to make, particularly standing on principle alone. I was pretty adamant initially. And after speaking with our attorneys and multiple attorneys, in fact, I mean, I called everybody that I could think of, anybody that I could get a referral for, to essentially try to find the answer that I wanted to hear. But in essence, you know, with everybody assuring me that it would probably not hold up in court. They would probably find us to be just fine, particularly since there was plenty of documentation that men had actually been a part of the Women's Forum historically. But essentially, it was going to set us back about $50,000 to $100,000 just to go through the litigation. And there's, you know, and again, there's no guarantees. So unfortunately, we had to make the really tough decision of not doing that.
And only, so how much did you end up settling for?
We ended up settling for $1,500.
$1,500.
Yeah. I mean, he basically is just like, we kind of lowballed his offer.
What was his offer?
To try to, he was initially, when he first emailed us, asking for $8,000, and then came back through DFEH and said, well, I would take $6,000. I mean, even after his first email, because essentially when he first reached out to us, because he had asked that question through our general email line and then emailed the business owners directly and said, well, I got this email. And it's a smoking gun. And essentially, you can pay me money. You can pay me $8,000 and I'll go away. Or if you don't, then I'm going to file a case against you.
Does sound like a shakedown.
Oh, yes. And indeed. And the thing about it is, when we responded that, you know, we apologized. We said, that is truly our bad. We didn't train our staff to you know, handle these types of emails, because it just didn't really occur to us that there would be this type of thing going on. We said that we were happy to accommodate him for the same price that the women were paying to participate in this educational forum. If he wants to learn about the flight, we could happily walk him through it.
A flight of beers.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
And he declined.
Ariella, I assume this was not the intent of the UNRUH Act.
It's not, although the UNRUH Act is written very broadly. Unlike the U.S. Constitution, for example, the UNRUH Civil Rights Act states all persons are free and equal no matter what, and then there's a long list that is also broader than what we protect under federal law. And because of that affirmative statement, but also because it's quite generous to plaintiffs and allows successful plaintiffs to have the other side cover their legal fees, it has been fertile ground for these lawsuits. And to some extent, the National Coalition for Men has been more successful in California because of our broad civil rights protections than it has been in other states like New York, where they've also brought a lot of lawsuits. So although the broad civil rights protections, you know, had been probably aimed more at women and people of color and other people who've been excluded from business and opportunities historically, as opposed to on behalf of men who've had all of these opportunities, nothing in the language prevents men from bringing suits, and they have successfully, for example, been able to win against ladies' nights at bars where ladies get in free or for a lower fee. I would agree with the lawyers that Ting consulted that, given they've never excluded men and have evidence of that, that they'd probably survive. But these suits are successful as takedown, unfortunately.
And that's because in the act, they don't have to pay their legal fees, the plaintiffs?
If they're victorious. So it's a risk you're taking. Uh-huh. I think what Ting's referring to is that even if she wins eventually, she just pays the lawyers for getting rid of the suit, and it's not worth it.
Yeah. So it seems like this would be a good opportunity for maybe a law school to have a clinic to provide free lawyers for these kinds of cases.
Well, we do have a small business clinic at USC to support businesses like Ting. So
where do you see this going forward? Do you think, Ariella, that there could be some legislation to amend the UNRUH Act so that it isn't abused?
It's tricky. As you know, it's a nationwide trend that anti-discrimination legislation and that was intended at the time to vindicate the rights of women and minorities is used to vindicate the rights of white or male plaintiffs. But that has a long history to it, and I don't think we're going to, you know, those reverse discrimination claims are now quite well established, and I doubt that's going to be reversed anytime soon.
And Ting, what does it mean for you going forward? I guess you don't have these women's beer nights anymore?
I do. I actually continued to do them. Our attorney advised for us to add a little kind of disclaimer at the bottom that despite the fact that it was initially created for people who identify as women, that if men want to attend, they can reach out to us. And then now we formally train our staff on how to respond to these things. So we're continuing to do it.
Well, Stephen Fry, if you're in the neighborhood, you're invited.
Absolutely. Love to have a drink with that guy.
All right. Well, I want to thank you both so much for joining us today.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Ting Hsu, owner of the Eagle Rock Brewery, and Ariella Gross, teaches law and history at USC. Coming up, why the British TV show Bodyguard became the most popular show there since Downton Abbey. That's next on Press Play. This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. It's Tuesday, time for our regular segment, TV on the Radio.
No one told you that was...
This is serious.
Gumby, no wonder.
There are the four bids. The actual retail price is...
We're going to talk about the British political thriller Bodyguard. It's by BBC One. It began airing in the UK back in August.
Did you mean what you said?
I don't need you to vote for me.
Are we facing a state of emergency?
I need to protect me.
Rest assured, Mum. I'll do what's required.
Okay. First episode drew more than 10 million viewers, the largest audience for a new drama on British television since Downton Abbey. It was so popular, even real-life politicians weighed in, including Prime Minister Theresa May. But maybe it was too close to home. She said she couldn't relax when she was watching it. Well, tomorrow, Netflix will release all 6 episodes of the show in 190 countries, including ours. Rosalind Sulkis wrote about that for The New York Times, where she writes about culture. Hi.
Hi.
Let's first explain the premise of the show. So there's the bodyguard.
Well, the premise is that an ex-Afghanistan vet who's back with perhaps some post-traumatic stress disorder is assigned to protect the Home Secretary. He's an extremely important figure in British government. And the story goes from there.
The Home Secretary, and she's a woman, so there's some chemistry, maybe.
Of course. Yes,
And the Home Secretary, that is an important title, right? Second only to the Prime Minister?
Yes, more or less. The Home Secretary is responsible for citizenship, immigration, all matters of national security. So both the police and the Secret Services report to him or her. In this case, it's a her.
And so she has a lot of power.
She has a huge amount of power.
That she might be wielding unethically, or she might be too... Well, that's one of the storylines, right?
Well, in this case, you don't really know what her motives are. The subplot is that both the Secret Service, MI5 in this case, who are responsible for national security as opposed to MI6, who deal with foreign security, a bit like the FBI and the CIA. MI5 is engaged in a sort of territorial warfare with the head of counterterrorism at the Metropolitan Police. And she's sort of playing them off. You don't really know where her allegiances lie or for which reasons she is cultivating one or the other. And that's part of the Hall of Mirrors plot that keeps you guessing all the way.
And she's played by an actress named Keeley Hawes.
Yes, who was a star in Line of Duty, which was written by the same person who has written Bodyguard, a man called Jed Mercurio, who's been a very successful television writer in Britain.
And tell us about the actor who plays Sergeant David Budd, the bodyguard.
Well, this is Richard Madden, who's best known, I think, to U.S. audiences for Game of Thrones, in which he played a character called
Robb Stark.
Robb Stark, that's right. And he is very charismatic in this. It's a wonderful performance, all the more so because he's, in fact, entirely inscrutable almost for the entire story.
He's, I guess, a strong silent type.
Very strong silent type, yes. And in fact, he's caused such a sensation that he's now being talked about as the next James Bond.
Oh, really? Mm-hmm. He does take his shirt off a few times in the opening episode.
A couple of times, but he remains inscrutable.
Well, he does. He sort of hints at a dark, tortured past, right? That he might have PTSD.
Well, we gather that in the first episode because we gather that he's estranged from his wife. He brings, after a very tumultuous opening episode or opening sequence in the first episode, he brings his children who are traveling with him, thus heightening the tension of what happens, back home. And we gather that he is not living with his wife and children. Mm-hmm. And she refers to his behavior. And we understand that there's some sort of out-of-control behavior that he isn't really admitting or acknowledging or handling very well. But we don't know until the series progresses exactly what has happened. It becomes clear that he does have post-traumatic stress disorder and that this is a result of his service in Afghanistan.
And the opening scene of the opening episode is incredibly riveting. It's long, played-out scene of a possible terrorist attack on a train. He's just taking the train. His kids are on the train and they're sleeping very cozily and innocently. But there's something afoot.
And yes,
he can sense it.
He picks this up right away because he's
hyper-vigilant.
Highly sensitized, hypervigilant security person. And he notices something going on. He follows it up and he discovers a would-be suicide bomber on the train. I won't say what happens, but it's an incredibly tense and very, for television, a very, very long episode focusing on just this one thing with no real cuts away to any other action. It's simply the situation that unfolds in what feels like real time.
Yeah. And that is something, of course, in real life that has happened in Britain, is terrorist attacks on trains and in the City of London. So is that part of the reason why Britain is so captivated by this show, is that it seems so real?
Well, that may be one reason. I think there are several reasons that I think perhaps intersect. One of them, in my opinion, is that it takes place in a sort of parallel universe in which there is no Brexit. Although it's very much a political thriller, very much set at Westminster, Brexit is not happening. And the primary political issue in the show is national security and a charter that the Home Secretary, the Keely Hawes character, who's called Julia Montagu, is trying to get through, called which has been nicknamed by the press in the series the Snoopers Charter, because it's a charter that she wants to pass that allows the government access to private correspondence, emails, etc. And she is doing this for reasons of national security. That's her line on it. And there's a lot of opposition, media opposition to it, and this is part of the drama that is playing out, conflated with the actual terrorist attack, which seems to give reason to what she wants to do.
So how have people reacted to that particular storyline? Because that is something that we here in the United States have dealt with in real life. Mm-hmm. And so how have people in Britain handled that?
Well, oddly enough, that whole Snoopers Charter idea in the series doesn't really seem to have been discussed very much in the media, although there was such obsessive discussion about the series. Every newspaper ran recaps and articles speculating about what was going to happen next, or why there were holes in the story or why they weren't. It was really a lot of conversation. But that one issue, I haven't seen a lot about, although when I talked to Richard Madden for the article I wrote, he did say that he thought that was something that really was very current in people's minds and one of the reasons that that the show had been so gripping.
Could the other reason be that here you have, I mean, it's almost like a traditional Western in a sense, that you've got this lone, strong, silent Gary Cooper type guy who's going to save the Republic from the invading hordes?
Absolutely. I mean, I think it gives us a world in which not only is there no Brexit, but there's someone with a solution to all these problems. As the series plays out, you actually, one of the things that Jed Mercurio, who wrote the show, did so well was to keep a level of ambiguity about Sergeant Budd's motives. Does he want to protect Julia Montagu? Is he resentful? He discovers she voted for troops to go to Afghanistan. He blames that for his own personal, the disintegration of his marriage and his personal life. Is he going to take revenge on her? Is he allied to the various plots that happen, bombings, other things that happen throughout the series? We don't really know. And we don't really know if he's that lone savior or if he's a more sinister figure.
Oh, interesting. So it isn't as simplistic as a High Noon, it's, a good and a bad.
It's not as simplistic as that. It gives us that lone hero figure, but asks us to question whether, in fact, that's who he is.
Hmm. Do you think, because you travel a lot to the United States, you've lived in the United States, do you think that this will find a similar obsessive audience here?
I don't know if it'll find quite as obsessive an audience. For one thing, there's so much more on offer in the U.S. in terms of political thrillers, conspiracy thrillers. I think that Bodyguard came at a time, end of summer, a very good time in the U.K., and it was a lone show of its type, and that may not be the case here. But I do think it will find an audience. I mean, it's a very, very well-written, well-acted, strong piece that's extremely suspenseful. I mean, one interesting thing is that, you know, in the UK, it showed once a week in a kind of old-fashioned way and really is written, I think, to end on cliffhangers, to have people wondering, talking, discussing what might happen next. And it really did that in the UK. There was a sort of water cooler effect. People wrote about this, that it took them back to the days of old-fashioned television when you went into the office and discussed, you know, last night's episode. And I think that did happen to some extent, even though there was, of course, it was watched on catch-up too. Here, with Netflix, it will be released all at once in 6 episodes. And so you can watch the entire thing in a day, if you so wish. And I do wonder how people will watch it and whether that will make a difference to the impact it has.
Okay, we'll see. We'll see tomorrow night.
Yes.
If that is the case.
Yes.
Rosalind Sulca is culture writer for The New York Times. She's written about Bodyguard for the paper. She's based in London. Thank you.
Thank you.
All right, Christian Bordahl is here now with some listener feedback. But before we get to you, Christian,
yes,
I just want to say something to the listeners about that interview we had yesterday with Kevin DeLeon, who's hoping to be the next U.S. senator replacing Dianne Feinstein. During that interview, he accused her of voting in favor of now Supreme Court Justice Brett Kavanaugh back in 2006. And that's when Kavanaugh was nominated for a seat on the D.C. Court of Appeals. Feinstein did vote to end debate on Kavanaugh's nomination in order to avoid a filibuster, and that put the vote to the full floor. But at that point, she voted against his confirmation to the Court of Appeals, the D.C. Court of Appeals. So just wanted to make that clarification. Fact checked. We couldn't do that in real time. So there it is.
There it is. Well, I have a few things that people had to say about Ting Su, the Eagle Rock brewery owner you talked about earlier. But people have to check those out at our Twitter and Facebook page, KCRW Press Play. I also ran a little Twitter poll to see whether people think there's going to be a blue wave in the November midterms. 45% said yes, 19% said no, 33% said not sure, 3% couldn't care.
Okay, thank you very much, Christian Bordahl. Hey, thanks for listening. I'm Madeline Brand, and I will see you tomorrow.